Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
This week in COVID history. As we head into April 2020, President Trump is a ratings hit. Mr. Trump and his coronavirus updates have attracted an audience of 8.5 million, roughly the viewership of the season finale of The Bachelor. That's not me talking. That's literally what the president tweeted. Word for word. It was weird.
Did you know I was number one on Facebook?
Number one on Facebook. So, Mr. Number One, how do we beat this pandemic? Maybe by wearing masks. The CDC says it's a good idea.
With the masks, it's going to be really a voluntary thing. You can do it. You don't have to do it. I'm choosing not to do it.
Great thinking, Mr. T. Who needs masks when you have tonight's sponsor? Hydroxychloroquine.
Hydrochloroquine.
Hydroxyquinolone.
It's unbelievable and totally untested.
We have purchased 29 million pills. We're sending them to the hospitals. We're sending them all over. There are signs that it works on this, some very strong signs.
But don't just take his word for it.
Everything shows that it works.
I think this is the beginning of the end of the pandemic. I'm very serious.
I think history will judge who's right on this debate. I bet on President Trump's intuition on this one.
Yes, our president knows best.
What do you have to lose? Take it.
Oh, my God. Can you believe that? And it actually happened, even though it's made to look like it's some old comedy. Willie Geist. Joe's off this morning, by the way. Willie, it's just hard to believe that those were the months and months that got us through this deadly pandemic, which is still going now, much in part because of claims like that.
Yeah, I mean, those are funny. Kimmel puts those together, but my gosh, they're devastating too, aren't they? To think a year ago, that was the kind of leadership we had and the kind of people we had guiding our policy. I'm reminded there was a man in Arizona who drank fish tank cleaner because it had chloroquine on the label, thinking that that was what President Trump was talking about. All of the recommendations, don't wear the mask. Peter Navarro, the man we saw in that clip, who's now saying that Dr. Fauci invented the virus or brought it from China or whatever his conspiracy theory is. Those were the people leading us in the earliest days of this pandemic and largely are why we are where we are still today.
And today is Friday, April 2nd. It's Good Friday, everyone. With us, we have former U.S. Senator, now in NBC News, and MSNBC political analyst Claire McCaskill with us. Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist and associate editor of the Washington Post and MSNBC political analyst Eugene Robinson, NBC News and MSNBC national affairs analyst, host and executive producer of Showtime's The Circus and host of the Hell and High Water podcast from The Recount, John Heilman is with us. And national reporter for The New York Times, Elena Plott. Thank you all for joining us. Joe will be back on Monday. We're following a number of developing stories this morning. It was another day of dramatic testimony in the trial of Derek Chauvin, the former police officer charged with the murder of George Floyd.
Floyd has this great, deep Southern voice, raspy. He's like, sis, you okay, sis? And I wasn't okay. I said, no, I'm just waiting for my son's father. Sorry. He said, well, can I pray with you?
Chauvin's defense team has argued that Floyd's underlying health conditions and drug use killed him. What do jurors think? We'll talk about that coming up. Plus, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell says President Biden's infrastructure package won't get any support from Republicans. Interesting. And Texas lawmakers advance a sweeping elections bill that places new restrictions on the voting process. Major corporations are voicing opposition to the measure, similar to what's going on in Georgia. It's creating an interesting rift between typically aligned Republicans and major corporations. New York Magazine's Jonathan Chait frames it this way, quote, Republicans are taking on big business by fighting to keep their taxes low. Huh? We'll get to all of that. Willie?
Yeah, busy morning. Let's start, though, with new developments in the Justice Department investigation into Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz. The New York Times now is reporting the inquiry into Gaetz and former Seminole County tax collector Joel Greenberg is focused on their suspected involvement with multiple women who, it is alleged, were recruited online for sex and received cash payments. That's according to people close to the investigation, text messages and payment receipts all reviewed by the Times. Three people with knowledge of the alleged encounters told the paper investigators believe Greenberg, who was indicted last year and pled guilty, not guilty to a federal sex trafficking charge and other charges, initially met the women through websites that connect people who go on dates in exchange for gifts, fine dining, travel, and allowances. Greenberg then reportedly introduced the women to Congressman Gaetz, who also had sex with them. Messages and interviews show that during encounters in 2019 and 20, Gaetz and Greenberg instructed the women to meet at certain times and places, often at hotels around Florida, and then would tell them the amount of money they were willing to pay. No charges have been brought against Congressman Gaetz, who's denied any wrongdoing and says there is an extortion plot against his family. The extent of his criminal exposure is unclear. In a statement to the Times, the congressman's office said, Matt Gaetz has never paid for sex, and he refutes all the disgusting allegations completely. Meanwhile, multiple sources telling CNN, Gaetz allegedly showed photos and videos of nude women he had slept with to other lawmakers, including while on the House floor. There is no indication the pictures are connected to the DOJ investigation. The Daily Beast reports more than a half dozen lawmakers have spoken about Gaetz, claiming a love of alcohol and illegal drugs, as well as alleging a proclivity for younger women. One former Republican staffer said their office had an informal rule to not allow their member to appear next to Gaetz during TV hits, fearful of the inevitable scandal that would come one day. A lot to sift through there. Let's bring in one of the reporters on the New York Times story, Michael Schmidt. He's also an MSNBC national security analyst. Also with us, former U.S. attorney for the Northern District of Alabama and an MSNBC legal analyst, Joyce Vance. Good morning to you both. Mike, let me start with you. This is your story. Bring us up to speed on some of these latest details you're just reporting this morning. Flesh it out. And how much more trouble does this put Mr. Gaetz in?
What we have here today in our story is sort of a deeper understanding of the conduct that was going on. As part of our reporting, we were able to look at some of the receipts. We were able to see some of the communications, the back and forth that was going on, how these women were being paid. They were being paid very, through apps on their phone, through Cash Apps, through Apple Pay. They were not taking great steps to hide these. At times, Gaetz or Greenberg would go to an ATM in the hotel that they were in. They would often meet these women in hotels. These are details that help us flesh out what the scheme was that was going on here that has been uncovered in this federal investigation. The other thing that we report today is that at least one of Gaetz and Greenberg's associates in Florida state politics, Republican state politics in Florida, has been, was linked to this behavior. We don't identify that associate, but it just gives you a sense of how wide and common and widespread this conduct was that is part of this investigation.
All right. Joyce Vance, I'm just curious, as it pertains to the concept of Michael Schmidt just talked about apps being used. I read about Apple Pay. I know there are a lot of lawmakers coming forward talking about his behavior on the House floor, showing pictures of women that he claimed to have slept with, and maybe even some lawmakers pulled him aside saying we need your conduct to be better on the House floor. But legally, what is he facing here on the concept of women being paid through apps? What are we looking at?
There are a lot of different possibilities for federal criminal exposure for the congressman related to this series of facts. And something that I've heard Mike say before that's very true is that the reporting is likely just the tip of the iceberg. For this to have gone so far and to have become a full-blown federal investigation, there are some reports that the initial tip took place in January of 2020. So this would be a year-long investigation if that pans out. And it's likely that there is a great deal more to back this up. But Mika, you're right to focus on payment. There is a specific statute that criminalizes, particularly when it comes to children and girls, the use of the internet or any sorts of interstate means to entice, to lure girls into this sort of commercial sex trafficking. But there's a whole panoply of federal statutes that are designed to address this. And most importantly, federal prosecutors take these sorts of crimes very seriously.
Mike, one of the questions a lot of people are looking into is whether office money from the congressman's office was used to pay for any of this. First of all, two-parter for you. Was this conduct that the DOJ is looking into all during his time as a congressman? He was took office in January of 2017. And second, is there any evidence that congressional money was used to pay for any of this?
So the conduct that we write about today is occurred during his time in Congress. He came to Congress in 2017, was elected as a Trump supporter in the 2016 election, and has been there since then. And obviously has been a very, very vocal supporter of the president. So that's where the conduct comes from. Just to pick up on what Joyce was saying, the thing that is the one of the biggest focuses of the legal questions in this case or in this investigation is the 17-year-old girl, because that crime of soliciting and paying someone under the age of 18 for sex carries a mandatory minimum of 10 years in prison. And that is obviously a very, very significant legal issue and is a humongous problem for Gates. As we report today, they are looking at Gates, as we reported in the original story, they're looking at Gates for his ties to the 17-year-old, and they're looking at others. Were others connected to this 17-year-old? Who else did this 17-year-old interact with?
So, Elena Plott, I'm just curious about how members of the GOP are responding to this. It appears some are, at least in some way, shape, or form, kind of saying, well, I've heard bad things, too, and sharing stories of pictures. There have been some indications that maybe some people didn't want to be in pictures with him because they saw this coming. What are you hearing?
Mika, this is the sort of thing thus far that when I have talked to Republicans since the story broke, the response is very similar to what it could often be when you would ask a lawmaker or a senior staff aide about Trump's tweets. They pretend to really just, want no involvement in it whatsoever, want to create as much distance as possible. But what I've also heard from a few people is that they're not entirely surprised, not just because of who Congressman Gates is in terms of the person they came to know over the years, but also how regular an occurrence that these sorts of clouds following behind Trump's favored lawmakers appear to be. What Trump did over the past 4 years is essentially, kind of help otherwise unknown lawmakers emerge into the spotlight very, very quickly. They really enjoyed it. They were suddenly golfing with the president of the United States when they're a young lawmaker. And I've had one source say to me, he flew too close to the sun, and you're seeing the fallout.
Claire, you're a former prosecutor as well as a former United States senator. So as your prosecutor hat on right now, what exactly are you looking at? Because there's this sort of separate issue put forward by Matt Gaetz and his people about an alleged extortion plot, which appears to be separate and apart from what the DOJ is focusing on in the alleged sex trafficking, what they're looking into. He hasn't been charged with anything. He denies that he had sex with anyone underage. But what would you be looking at right now specifically?
Well, first, I think Joyce will back me up on this. This is only a federal case if they can prove that money or interstate communications were used to entice or pay someone 17 years old or younger. If it's older than 17, then this becomes a local prosecutor. This becomes a state prosecution. And sometimes those are riddled with political decisions as opposed to decisions on the facts and the law. So it will be interesting to see if, in fact, they find the evidence of a 17-year-old, if the feds go forward, or in the alternative, if you see some kind of action by local prosecutors. But let's just look at this from a political lens for a minute, Willie. I mean, the quote that this guy gave to the press yesterday was, "I cherished my past relationships." Meanwhile, you have, I'm sure, Republican lawmakers telling the press he was showing them naked pictures of these women, going to such detail of saying one of them was a naked picture with a hula hoop. Now, to me, as just an average person, that is not what you do with a relationship you cherish. That's what you do if you're peddling, if you're somebody who's a John, if you're somebody who's buying sex and living a lifestyle that is not consistent with representing America in the United States Congress. I think this guy's in some real political trouble, even if he ends up just facing state charges around prostitution for what he did.
So, John Hellman, this story seems to be exploding on many levels, and people keep adding to it, some of them anecdotes coming from Washington, from Capitol Hill, that Paul Ryan pulled him aside at one point, that his conduct on the floor was in question. What is it? Is it his closeness to Trump that is causing such an emphasis on this story, or is it his really severe, full-throated, immediate response to this investigation when it first came out, you know, jumping onto cable TV and sort of luring Tucker Carlson into this? What is it that makes this story, I guess, so important at this point to people?
Well, I think, Mika, I mean, look, he is, I mean, Matt Gaetz is a rising star in Congress in the context of the Trump era. I'm saying within the Republican Party, you know, of the bright young things who showed up literally in Trump's election, validated by Donald Trump, lifted up by Donald Trump, he returned the favor. Donald Trump and he were in a symbiotic relationship. And so he became more than just your average one of 435 members of the House. He became a guy with an outsized presence in right-wing media. And to some extent in mainstream media, he would not really turn down any television interview requests. He made himself ubiquitous. He was very loud. He was very brash. He understood how to play in the Trump era when volume mm-hmm. and shamelessness and garishness were the kind of badges of honor and the things that attracted media attention. Matt Gaetz was the perfect flower of that moment. And so now, you know, of course, we are now learning that this Florida bro, basically, you know, turns out who was running around with an indicted sex trafficker, and has been walking around apparently showing his best pictures off his phone to his friends on the House floor of his sexual, I don't even want to call them conquests, because if you're paying for them, they're not conquests, right? So it turns out that the guy is by every indication, what we're hearing now, he's skeevy. And I would say, you know, what the dynamic uh-huh. here is, and this gets to Claire's point, I don't actually think it matters. I mean, I think it matters whether there's a federal charge here. If there's a sex trafficking charge here, that matters. It matters if there's a state charge. Those are legal things, right? But I think regardless of whether charges are brought now, the floodgates are now open. And on a political level, a lot of members of Congress in the Republican Party who, even if they have sidled up to Trump, even if they have accepted Donald Trump, even if they got down, you know, they got in bed with the fleas in Donald Trump, they are looking for, mm-hmm. they have looked at people like Matt Gaetz and said, man, this is a stinky, pile that we're stuck with here. This is an opportunity for Republicans, I think, right now in a totally self-interested way to be like, let's get away from that. And let's take some kind of a purely cynical public relations driven approach, which is like, let's get our high horse. They have no moral standing to take this position, by the way. But to throw Matt Gaetz over the side will make them feel better. And they think give them some kind of credibility for having walked away from someone who is clearly, like I said, at this point, I think terminally toxic.
Yeah, terminally toxic might be a good way of putting it, looking at everything. But Willie, you just wonder if there's any talk in Congress about taking away his committee assignments or resignation even.
Well, Kevin McCarthy actually alluded to that when asked. The minority leader said, yeah, we would probably yank him off the judiciary committee, if these allegations prove to be true. So you don't see a lot of Republicans, even, as John said, rushing to Gaetz's defense here. And let's remember, Gene Robinson, this is the guy in Congressman Gaetz who back in January caught a flight from Washington to Cheyenne, Wyoming, to speak out on the steps of the Capitol to call for Liz Cheney to be thrown out of office because she dared to vote to impeach Donald Trump.
Right. He was, in his mind, at least riding high. Then he was thinking of himself as a national figure, clearly. And he's now a national figure in a completely different way. But I do have a question from Mike Schmidt, which is, what do we know about the women allegedly involved in this this affair, this in the circumstance, or in the one case, the girl who was 17. What, if anything, we know about them?
So what we know is that they were connected to Greenberg initially through these websites that are designed to connect people who are willing to exchange gifts, dinners, travel, fine dining for companionship. These are websites that, you know, essentially look like dating websites, but are, you know, have a bit more edge to them and are about connecting people, and that these types of connections often result in payments that lead to sex. It's these types of sites that are often at the center of, you know, federal and state investigations that look at sex trafficking. And that is where the women were coming from. As we report today, Greenberg would make sort of the recruitment of the women, would make the contact with the women, would bring them in and introduce them to Gaetz, and that Gaetz would, have relations with the women, and that this would sort of continue on. And that was sort of a pipeline that was used. Among the women that were brought in was one of these women who was 17 years old. And that has that issue of who knew this 17-year-old and who had relations with this 17-year-old is a very, very key question of what is being scrutinized, as Claire pointed out, because that is a in the eye of the law, that is a right. A significant distinction that really changes the criminal exposure for both Greenberg and Gaetz. We should point out, Greenberg, who's this local tax collector, a guy who embraced Trumpism and was the tax collector in Seminole County right outside of Orlando, has been indicted for sex trafficking in connection with the 17-year-old girl. As we report today, the questions about Gaetz and the 17-year-old are of the same woman. It's the same woman that they the same woman that they're looking at, whether Gaetz had relations with. So, look, it's a federal investigation. There's a lot going on with it. We do not have complete visibility into everything, but we're just trying to peel back the layers, you know, one story at a time.
Michael Schmidt, thank you very much for your reporting this morning. We'll be following this. And now to day four of the Derek Chauvin trial. NBC's Gabe Gutierrez takes us through yesterday's emotional testimony.
It didn't take long for Courtney Ross to cry as she remembered how she met George Floyd in 2017.
Floyd's what I would call mama's boy. I could tell from the minute I met him.
This now iconic photo of Floyd, Ross said, was taken as a selfie at the Salvation Army where he worked.
Floyd has this great, deep, Southern voice. Rest.
They began dating, and she told jurors how he was devastated by the death of his mother.
He seemed kind of like a shell of himself. Like he was broken. He seemed so sad.
During her testimony, yeah, meant to humanize Floyd, one juror off camera had a furrowed brow and one of his hands up by his masked face, seemingly emotional. Ross said injuries and his desire to still be physically active led Floyd to pain pills.
We both suffered from chronic pain. Mine was in my neck and his was in his back. We got addicted and tried really hard to break that addiction. Many times.
In March of 2020, Ross testified she drove Floyd to the hospital and learned he'd overdosed.
You did not know that he had taken heroin at that time?
No.
Derek Chauvin's defense team has argued that Floyd's underlying health conditions and drug use killed him, not the 9 minutes and 29 seconds that prosecutors say the former Minneapolis officer held his knee on Floyd's neck. The next two witnesses, paramedics, said Floyd had no pulse when EMS arrived at the scene.
I didn't see any breathing or movement or anything like that.
In lay terms, I thought he was dead.
Testimony came after prosecutors on Wednesday played body camera videos from all four officers that responded, including Chauvin's, which had not been seen publicly before. His camera fell beneath a police squad car as officers struggled with Floyd. Later, Chauvin's voice is heard explaining why he restrained Floyd for so long.
Trying to control this guy because he's a sizable guy.
Yeah, and I thought he didn't get in the car.
Looks like he's probably on something.
Felonious Floyd was in the courtroom as prosecutors showed graphic images of the efforts to resuscitate his brother inside the ambulance.
There's no justification why a person should put their knee and all of their weight on a man's neck until they pass. He was tortured to death.
Prosecutors also used two body camera clips showing Chauvin's former supervisor, David Ploeger, going to the scene and speaking with Chauvin after fielding complaint calls from witnesses. Ploeger offered the following testimony.
Do you have an opinion as to when the restraint of Mr. Floyd should have ended in this encounter?
Yes.
What is it?
When Mr. Floyd was no longer offering up any resistance to the officers, they could have ended their restraint.
And that was after he was handcuffed and on the ground and no longer resistant.
Correct.
Joyce Vance, as the trial resumes later this morning, you've been watching so far. What are your thoughts? It seems like the prosecution has a very powerful case.
They do have a powerful case. It's been really painful to watch, Mika. The evidence is of a very high caliber. I've tried a number of excessive force cases. This case is unique. There's video footage from virtually every angle between the body cameras and the bystanders. And you hate to say good fortune in a case like this, but the prosecution has had the good fortune, for instance, of having an off-duty EMT on scene who relentlessly badgered the officers to try to render assistance to Mr. Floyd.
Gosh.
So the big issue that we're building up to in this case is causation. Who caused the death of Mr. Floyd? Was it the knee on the neck, or was it, as the defense is going to argue, his underlying medical conditions and his drug addiction? So far, the prosecution has managed to set a really masterful emotional context for the jury to hear that technical medical evidence about causation. And it's tough after hearing this testimony and watching the video to attribute his death to anything other than former Officer Chauvin's actions. It will be, I think, interesting to watch the battle of the medical examiners, which is where this trial is inevitably headed.
Yeah, Joyce, as you say, the testimony over the first 4 days has been emotional at times, but more importantly for the prosecution, it's been compelling. When you hear a former supervisor, Sergeant Ploeger, say yesterday that restraint should have ended long before it did, that once that Mr. Floyd wasn't resisting arrest anymore, the restraint should have ended. That's powerful testimony. So you started to answer my question, but I'm curious where you think the defense can go from here. Their defense has been relatively thin so far in the face of all these witnesses. Where do you see their strategy going?
We're still in the prosecution's case in chief. So if the prosecution wasn't didn't have an edge here, then there would be reason for great concern. Once the government's evidence is finished, the defense will have the opportunity to put on evidence of their own. Traditional wisdom in a case like this is says that the defendant should not testify, that it's very dangerous to testify. Of course, the defense has no burden of proving anything in a case like this. The defendant is presumed innocent until the government proves that he's guilty. So it seems unlikely that we'll see Chauvin testify. But the defense really may reach the point where they have to consider that seriously, because their options here are to poke holes at the government's case on Chauvin's intent for the three different species of murder and manslaughter that he's charged with. They have to prove different states of mind, but at bottom, they'll have to show that he had a reckless disregard for human life. It looks pretty tough to get around that in this case. And then the big issue is causation, showing that there were alternative substantial causes of death. That will depend on how the expert testimony and the medical testimony comes in. But increasingly, you know, the defense's strategy may not be an acquittal. It may be to just find one juror that they can convince to hold out, to refuse to vote for guilt, so that the jury hangs and they can try the case, presumably a second time. The prosecution won't let this one go if the jury hangs.
Joyce Vance, thank you. And we want to mention, by the way, the new podcast Joyce co-hosts, along with Kimberly Atkins and Barbara McQuaid and Jill Wine Banks, called hashtag Sisters-in-Law. I love it. Sisters-in-Law. All right, Gene Robinson, you've written a piece that is entitled Kneeling on George Floyd's Neck, Sent a Message to Everyone Who Saw It. Explain that. Tell us about your piece.
Well, the way he is, George Floyd, was described by Chauvin, and obviously seen by Chauvin, and indeed initially encountered by the officers, actually, is another officer. It's just striking to me. From the beginning, they saw him as guilty of being a black man with an imposing frame who had to be treated or whom they could treat in a way they wouldn't treat other people, or one hopes they wouldn't treat anybody this way. I mean, you know, the initial encounter, which would be between one of the other officers and Floyd, you know, the officer knocks on the window of the car, and Floyd starts startled and starts to open the door and says, "Oh, I'm sorry. And the officer pulls out his gun and screams, you know, "Get your effing hands up," which is that's amazing. This was over a nonviolent misdemeanor, allegedly passing a $20 bill, yet out comes the gun immediately, and then they feel that they need to drag him out and put him on the ground and cuff him, and ultimately the Chauvin, in restraining him for that long, to my eyes, seems not to be restraining Floyd after a certain point, because in fact Floyd is unconscious, obviously, but he's demonstrating something for that group of onlookers. He's demonstrating who's in charge, and it's him. It's not this black man who's on the ground, and it's not those onlookers who are criticizing him. Chauvin is in charge, and this is his world, and he gets to decide when he shows humanity and compassion, or whether he shows humanity and compassion to George Floyd. And that's what is striking to me about the testimony, about the video. One of the witnesses, that older man, Charles McMillan, the other day testified. He told Floyd at one point, you know, you can't win. And that was true. He just couldn't win from the beginning.
Still ahead on Morning Joe, some major corporations are speaking out against Georgia's sweeping new election law. And now Republican lawmakers are hitting back. Plus, could the surge of coronavirus variants outpace the increasing availability of vaccines? It's a huge question. Dr. Michael Osterholm joins us to weigh in on that. You're watching Morning Joe. We will be right back.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
The pharmaceutical companies Pfizer and BioNTech announced trials suggesting their COVID vaccine protects against the South African variant. The companies also said in their phase three trials of more than 12,000 people, their vaccine shows, quote, high levels of protection as long as 6 months after the second dose with no serious safety concerns. Joining us now, director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy and a professor in the medical school at the University of Minnesota, Dr. Michael Osterholm. Dr. Osterholm, always great to see you. We love having you on because you never pull any punches. You cut right to the chase. So let me just ask you, we have all this optimism about the vaccines. It's become readily available, opened up to more age groups, and yet we're seeing hospitalizations go up. We're seeing infections go up again. So big picture, what's going on in the country with COVID right now?
Well, it's a tale of two cities. The vaccine news is good. These are incredible vaccines. The challenge we have is we just don't have enough quick enough to get into the arms of people in terms of trying to take on this new variant, this B117 virus that was originally seen in the United Kingdom. The upper Midwest and Northeast right now are experiencing major upticks in cases, and we have a lot of people left that are still out there to be infected. We expect to see this virus spread through much of the South and the West in the weeks ahead. So we have a real challenge on our hands, and we clearly are in another surge of cases.
So how do you explain the surge? Is it just that people are exhausted and they've been relaxed and they can go back out? We're seeing some ballparks start to fill up again in Texas, for example. Restaurants are open. People are getting back to normal life after a year of this. And because I think a lot of that good news that you mentioned gives them hope and optimism that they can return safely to something resembling normal life anyway. So why are we seeing those spikes and why are you expecting more of them?
Well, I think, first of all, you've really detailed it quite nicely in terms of this roller coaster emotionally. Just 4 weeks ago on this show, everyone wanted to know why I was more optimistic. Cases were coming down. And I understand that. One of the things I don't think people realize, as much as public health measures surely have impacted on the number of new cases, think about this. Last April, we had a house on fire in New York. Some states are in the Midwest. And we were at 32,000 cases a day. Oh my, the house was on fire. Then we saw in the Memorial Day time period, the upper Midwest lit up again, about the same number of cases, came back down. July, the southern states lit up. We had 72,000 cases a day. That went back down. Then post-Labor Day, cases went up in the Midwest again. By November, we were at 200,000 cases. Then cases came back down again. And finally, in December, January, we hit over 300,000 cases a day, and the South lit up again. So we've had these roving regional increases up and down, up and down, up and down. And I think we're in that right now, except this time we have a much more dangerous virus. This B117 virus is at least 70 to 100% more infectious and is at least 50 to 60% more likely to cause severe disease. And the other issue that really is a major challenge is spreading readily in young kids, which we hadn't seen in the COVID viruses prior to B117.
We heard just a few days ago, Dr. Walensky, the CDC director, kind of pause at her briefing and say, I have a sense of impending doom if we don't continue to take this thing seriously, continue to mask, continue to distance, continue to do all the things we've recommended. We heard the same from President Biden saying, please, please continue to wear the masks. He's encouraged governors to keep mask mandates in place. A lot of them and said, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to keep them optional. From your vantage point, what do we need to do, all Americans, to make sure that we don't have this big surge that we're looking at right now?
Well, let me just first of all say that we are so fortunate to have Dr. Walensky as the director of the CDC. She is the right person at the right time, and her message was the right message, and I commend her for that. I think what we have to do right now is just realize we are in a race with this virus, the B117. If we can get through the next 8 to 10 weeks with limited number of cases because we do distance, because we don't give up at the last minute, then I think we have a chance getting into the summer to actually have the past 2 years. If we don't, we're going to see case numbers climb up and potentially get to where we were in January, where we're already right now in some locations in the upper Midwest beginning to feel that way. So I think it's really a challenge. You know, Willie, no one wants to be the person who dies from COVID 2 days before they're supposed to get their vaccination. You know, we just please hold out and we can get there.
So a couple of questions out of that. First of all, does the vaccination apply to all these variants that you're talking about, especially the ones that travel quickly through children or the variants that are coming from abroad? Do we have an issue there? And secondly, what are the chances we go right back to January because people aren't holding on and they aren't social distancing and holding back? They just aren't. I mean, that's what I'm seeing. So I have to ask what it's going to look like.
Well, no, two very important questions. The first question, there is good news. This B117 variant we're dealing with here in the United States right now, basically the vaccine covers it very well. It's highly, highly effective against it. There are other variants in the world that we are watching carefully, particularly ones in South America, one in Africa, that does have the ability to impact on how well the vaccines work or immunity from natural infection. As far as your second point, you know, what people don't understand is with all the pain and suffering and death that we've suffered over the last year, even though we have vaccinated as many people as we have, we still have upwards of 50% of the population still susceptible to this virus. And so it's going to find you. This is a coronavirus forest fire that will find any human wood out there to burn it can. So we just got to hold out. We've got to get more people vaccinated. And if we can do that, then I think we can avoid that January peak. If we don't, I'm not suggesting we're going to get there, but we're going to get close. On a global basis, we are blowing away the peaks that we had before. I think within the next 3 weeks, we will see the most number of cases reported globally we have since the beginning of the pandemic, which says just how dark it is in many countries around the world.
All right, Dr. Michael Osterholm, it is always an honor to have you on the show. Thank you very much for being on this morning. Okay, Texas Republicans are looking to push a bill through the state legislature that seems that it will make it harder for residents to vote. After more than 7 hours of objections from Democrats, Texas GOP-controlled Senate signed off on the legislation on Thursday, sending it to the House. The bill would cut early voting hours and drive-through voting, make it illegal for election officials to send vote-by-mail applications in advance. It would also allow poll watchers to record some voters as they cast their ballots. Texas corporate giants such as Dell and American Airlines have come out against the new bill. That comes as several Georgia-based companies are facing backlash from Republicans after expressing their dissatisfaction with the state's new voting law. Delta Airlines and Coca-Cola find themselves in a heated fight with Governor Brian Kemp after Delta CEO Ed Bastian condemned the restricted voting rights bill. Republicans in the state legislature are looking at increasing taxes on the company, seemingly as retribution. Senator Roger Wicker of Mississippi tweeted that Coca-Cola was, quote, caving to the woke left. And Republican Senator Marco Rubio of Florida posted a video calling the two companies, quote, woke corporate hypocrites.
So Delta Airlines are business partners with the Chinese Communist Party, the same Chinese Communist Party that is committing genocide against Uyghur Muslims inside of China. So I look forward to a letter today from their CEO telling everyone that what the Chinese Communist Party is doing with genocide is unacceptable. I look forward to that letter saying that genocide does not reflect the values of Delta Airlines. Of course, they're not going to send that letter, nor is Coca-Cola, nor is any of these other corporations that are out there proving to the world how woke they are, because they are woke corporate hypocrites. That's what they are. They're woke corporate hypocrites. They make billions of dollars in a country that doesn't even have elections. They make billions of dollars working with a country that has no respect for anyone or anything, and they don't say a word about it. But in America, they're prepared to boycott a state and condemn them publicly to show and prove how woke they are. They're hypocrites, complete and total hypocrites.
So much to unpack there, Elena Platt, Marco Rubio. Let's just stay focused here. Just on the wokeness, that seems to be a word that they want to repeat a lot again and again, in a fashion that denigrates it. And while that's an incredible argument, but I find it more incredible that they're going after these corporations and yet they don't plan to support Joe Biden's infrastructure bill. Do you see the part where I'm a bit confused? Like, which is it for them? Are they the hypocrites?
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.
We saw something quite similar for Republicans, Mika, in 2017, if you'll remember, when North Carolina and Texas, for that matter, was trying to push forward what they called the bathroom bills, which would have prohibited transgender individuals from using the restroom that was of their choice. That failed in Texas. North Carolina ultimately scaled it back a great deal because there was this sort of corporate backlash. What I think is interesting this time is that Governor Greg Abbott, who took really great care in 2017 to telegraph to the business community that he really didn't like what was going on, despite the fact that he was kind of trying to have it both ways with the bill's supporters as well. Governor Greg Abbott is all on board with this voting rights legislation. His lieutenant governor, Dan Patrick, has issued forceful denunciations of American Airlines for coming out against it. And so what I think you're seeing is a pretty major and telling inflection point in the direction of the party. You know, in the past, we would talk about how one of the major changes Trump brought to the GOP was in large part tonal. But I think now we're seeing the policy implications and how deeply those could be rooted even after he's gone, or since he's been gone, I should say.
So in his latest column for New York Magazine entitled "The Fake Republican Fight with Corporate America," Jonathan Chait writes in part, "It is no longer just the self-styled populists and Trump personality cult devotees who are plumping for open conflict with corporate America. The Wall Street Journal editorial page has joined the ranks of conservatives denouncing woke capital. A House Republican strategy memo urges members to use corporations' preference for the Democratic Party to drive individual donations. What this little tiff lacks, however, is any coherent policy content. A populist argument would be that airlines should pay a higher tax rate and that their favorable treatment is the result of undue influence on the system. Georgia Republicans aren't saying that. They're not making any substantive case against the airline tax break at all, in fact. Instead, they're explicitly using the issue as a club to force corporations to stay loyal or at least neutral on issues Republicans care about. It's revealing that the supposed Republican schism with corporate America is occurring against the backdrop of a debate over raising taxes on corporations. If Republicans want to engage in actual political conflict with big business, here is their golden opportunity. Claire McCaskill, your thoughts.
Yeah, you know, I'm getting whiplash. I can't figure this out. You know, first they say corporations are people, and therefore we get to have all the dark money, corporate money in elections, and Republicans are rah, 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 corporations are people. Then corporations speak out about what they think is right and wrong in a country that treasures the First Amendment. And then the Republicans get into a hypocritical four-point stance on we're going to be the cancel culture. And by the way, they've been using this cancel culture as their rallying cry. Hello, Colin Kaepernick. Hello, what they're doing right now to American Airlines and to Delta and to Coca-Cola. I mean, which is it? They can't decide whether they want to tax them to punish them, which, by the way, takes the cancel culture to a whole new level of impinging upon people's First Amendment rights in this country, or whether they want to embrace them and say, let's see how low we can get your taxes so you can compete on a global marketplace. And give me a break with Marco Rubio. Oh, just be quiet. Where have you gone? You have no substantive center. There is no center you believe in. You know, you want to talk about hypocritical. There's all kinds of things that Marco Rubio has been doing that are just bogus and hypocritical. So I don't get this. They are engaging in the very activity they want to criticize others of. And meanwhile, these corporations, I think, are just speaking out on what they think is the right thing to do for America.
Gene Robinson, it's been interesting to watch the progression of these corporations' reaction. They started out with sort of timid responses. At first, they were taking a close look at this law. And then as the heat was really turned up, they came out more forcefully, particularly the CEO of Delta. Yeah. But the fact of the matter is, it's not going to change the law. You know, they've got a Republican governor there. It's going through there, and there will be new limitations on voting. Now, the governor says many aspects of this law actually expand voting for some people in some places. But the essence of what people are protesting about this law will remain in place.
Right. And this is an issue that's not going away. It's going to be fascinating to see how corporations deal with it going forward, because, you know, we're now going to have the debate in Congress over H.R. 1, the Democrats' proposal for voting rights. And so where do, you know, the question is going to be, where do you stand on that? And what are the polls saying, and what are their customers telling them? It's going to be their shareholders. It's going to be really interesting. Just a quick question for John Heilman, actually, which is restricting voting, is voter suppression basically the issue that the Trump and non-Trump wings of the Republican Party, to the extent that the non-Trump wing still exists, that they can all agree on? Is that what unites the Republican Party now, is the idea of voter suppression?
Yes, Eugene. I mean, I think, first of all, we should start with that first question. Is there a non-Trump wing of the Republican Party anymore? I'm not sure there is. Look, I think this is an existential thing for the Republican Party. What does the Republican Party believe in? It believes in winning and trying to hold on to power. And the reality is that in this country, if the country was governed in a strictly majoritarian way, our Republicans would lose. And that, by which I mean, you know, the combination of gerrymandering in the House, the geographic prejudices that are built into the Senate, and the Electoral College all give Republicans ways to have more power than their degree of national support. And so the combination of those things and finding that in order to make to continue to exploit those geographic leverage points, it's important for Republicans, essential for importance, I said existential a second ago, to restrict the rights of people to vote who are not certain, because people have, you know, free will and whatever. And we've seen things like Hispanic voters drifting towards the Republican Party. So none of these things are set in stone. But Republicans see the writing on the wall, and they see the notion that larger degrees of participation, particularly for non-white voters, spells doom for them. They are already on the wrong side of the They're already on the wrong side of this majoritarian dynamic in the country. And if you see expanded access a start to allow Democrats to chip into their geographic advantages, the party is in big, big trouble. And so on that front, this isn't a Trump thing. This is a how do we save our party in a context where the demography matched up with greater voter access would make it very hard for the Republican Party to continue to have any real purchase in national politics. And so they will do whatever they need to do to make it harder for voters they think are not going to vote for them to vote.
All right. John Heilman, Elena Plott, and Eugene Robinson, thank you all for being on this morning. We really appreciate it. And coming up, the Biden administration launches a new effort to combat coronavirus vaccine hesitancy. We'll talk to Surgeon General Vivek Murthy about that. Morning Joe's coming right back.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.